Welcome to Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Marvin Cook, OBE, was a relatively junior engineer back in 1991 when he joined the Toyota factory in Derby. But during the next 30 years, he rose to the rank of Executive Vice President for Manufacturing at Toyota Europe. There, he was responsible for Toyota production right across the continent. That's more than 800,000 vehicles a year, 20,000 staff at plants in Britain, France, Poland, Czech Republic and Turkey. And some of those plants are making cars at the rate of one every minute. Marvin is an accomplished leader. He is now Professor of Enterprise at the University of Derby Business School. And this month, he was awarded an OBE for his services to automotive manufacturing. But we'd like to think it all started here, back in the day when Marvin graduated from Nottingham Trent with his degree in electrical engineering. So Marvin Cook, welcome back and thanks very much for joining us for this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast.
Hello, Mike. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good stuff. Has it changed much?
Yes, a lot. I was in the Newton building and I came back to do a lecture there a few years ago, and I couldn't believe how much it had changed. It's now a business school.
Oh, yes. I'm glad we've moved with the times. So, belated congratulations on the OBE. I think it was the King's New Year's Honours List. How long did you have to keep that a secret?
About a month.
About a month, yeah.
And I'll be very honest. I picked up the post that day, gave the quick flick through as you do. No. Passed them on to my wife because she's excellent at managing and filing all of those kind of things. I thought it was a bill. And then she said, can I open this one? It's got your name on it. Yeah, please go ahead. And after a moment, she says, you better sit down for this one. It's what it is. So it came as a huge shock.
So no hint of it beforehand?
Not at all.
Just a letter in the post.
Total surprise. But no, I have to say, though, it's very humbling and it is truly an honour. But I've been lucky. I've worked with a lot of great people in my career and I had huge support from my wife and family. So, you know, I truly share it with them.
Good stuff. So, I don't like to date you here, but you joined Toyota way back in, is it September 1991? Young engineer.
Yes.
So, 30-odd years later, you were Executive Vice President Toyota Europe, as I said. So, I can hear people at Nottingham Business School asking, is that kind of rising through the ranks career still possible in industry today?
Yes, I think it is. I can't say for every company, but certainly, of course, when I joined Toyota 33 years ago, I never imagined that I would be there for over three decades. I don't think you do. It was the third company I'd worked for. But I guess I found something in Toyota that I really enjoyed, and Toyota gave me a lot of opportunity. You know, I wasn't doing the same thing for that period of time, doing different roles, very different roles in different places, different countries. But I think Toyota as a company appreciates that experience that you bring with you and very much the values and the culture. It is a very, you know, deeply rooted cultural business with a degree of philosophy, you know, technique and practice that it helps if you've got people who understand that. At the same time, I think you still need to bring people from outside, and Toyota has always done that. To keep things fresh and to make sure that you're diverse in your thinking, for example.
I know you say you were lucky, you were there, but on reflection, if you had your time again, would you go and target a company like Toyota? Because, you know, you talked about philosophy and values and things of that nature and being given opportunity. Is that worth a 20-odd-year-old coming out of university now thinking, just a minute, I want to work for somebody who has these values, who does this? Is that the kind of thing you would do on reflection?
Yeah, and I did it then, if I'm honest. I was living in Carlisle. I was working for Pirelli at the time, when I saw in the news that Toyota were coming. And coincidentally, I've been studying the Toyota production system. It was something that Pirelli were doing all those years ago, and that was what piqued my interest. It was only when I joined the company I realised the depth of the values beyond that, you know, the Toyota way rather than just the technical side. I think that came later. But yeah, I would always advise people to do the homework on a company. I think most people do these days. And I think with the social media and everything that's out there, it's a wise move.
It's a wise move, right. And of course, you were in Carlisle, but you were born and bred in Derby, so that brought you back to Derby because the plant was being set up there in the 90s.
Absolutely, yeah. I started my career as a 16-year-old in the Pirelli Tyre Company in Burton-on-Trent. And after I then was fortunate enough to come here to Nottingham-Trent and study electronic engineering. And soon after that, they said, well, would you like to go to Carlisle? I thought, well, why not, you know? Engineering job up there.
I've got a few friends who might say, I know why not, but that's another story.
Well, I so, but I was young and it was different. It was new, really enjoyed it. I did actually leave Pirelli to come back and work in the food and drinks industry back in Burton-on-Trent, actually. And I did that for a few years before joining Toyota. But yeah, it brought me back home, back to the city where I was born.
Okay. So, you know, looking back then, I think, as you say, you were a 16-year-old at Pirelli Tyre Works in Burton. I remember it well. So what do you know now that you really wish you'd known then?
I joined Pirelli because I wanted to get into engineering. And I'd always enjoyed technical things, you know, from a very young age. And I saw that opportunity with them. But I have to be honest, I fell into that by chance. I got a place at the age of 16 originally to go to Derby College to do three A-levels, as you do, you know. I can't remember, probably physics, math and business or something, you know, at that time. And my father had his own business, kitchen business, and he came home one night. He said, I met this guy who's the training manager of Pirelli, the fit in his kitchen. And we've been talking about you and think you might want to meet him. We're going over tomorrow night. And he said, we're going to talk about apprenticeships. Like, well, what's an apprenticeship? And I went over there and chatted with the then Pirelli training manager and thought, yeah, why not? And he said, look, here's an application form if you fancy give it a go. And I did. Took along all of my projects that I'd been making as a kid, electronic projects, and that seemed to create something to talk about. You know, it's a good thing to take something to talk
absolutely.
About. And that was it. Yeah, so it was purely by chance.
Okay. But you knew, what, 16-year-old, you thought, just a minute, I fancy being an engineer.
Yeah, I did, yeah. I always enjoyed technical things. But I think, you know, at that age, I never imagined, of course, going into leadership. And I think at an early age, there are a lot of things you don't realise about leaders, and you wish you knew. I probably wish I knew them, because I've always had quite imposter syndrome, and also quite a degree, you know, fear of failure. And I mean by that, you know, I want to do well for the people I work with and for the people who are working for me.
Okay, so that's a candid admission. How did you get over that?
Yeah, well, I learned later that at a young age, I wish I spoke to more leaders earlier. Because when I started speaking to, you know, other leaders either in the company I work with or outside of that, I found actually they probably had more in common than me than I first thought. You know, I thought these leaders were kind of a different breed. You know, they must have been born differently, but I don't think that is the case. And a lot of us, and I'll include myself in this, you know, became an accidental manager and had to really learn along the way. I come from the technical side, but there was someone, I think it was the HR manager when I was in Pirelli, said to me, you know, if you really want to enhance your career, you probably might want to think more broadly than just engineering. We're a production business. Mm-hmm. Get interested in that, learn about that. And I thought that was a good hint, really. It's up to you.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did, and I followed that lead and began to become more interested and show more interest. And then, you know, later on in life, when I joined Toyota, I realised there that even though I was an engineer still at that time, I had that interest in production. And I said, look, I want to be the next manager of production here in the area that I was working, and made that sort of desire quite clear. But when I was much younger, you know, I didn't sort of think like that. And
yeah, I get that. So you don't think at the start that you were thinking, just a bit, I want to be in charge. I mean, you know, so it wasn't a thing whereby you thought whatever you'd done, I was going to be in charge. It was you were feeling your way through, as it were.
Absolutely. You know, and I think a lot of us who ended up where we were in leadership probably didn't have that clear roadmap or plan in the outset. And, you know, for me, I'd always had ambition.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you are, you know, I'm reading through your bio and reading some of the material you've put out online there. You're obviously competitive. You're obviously ambitious. And is that important for leaders?
I think having ambition and having some idea, you know, what kind of things might I want to be doing in the next 5 years or so, and having that idea in your mind is quite important. And I think there's in leaders there is a natural degree of competitiveness, but I don't believe in being competitive at the expense of others, you know. Right. And I think if competitive to do well in the business, for the business, for the people is important. But I don't think, you know, I don't like this, well, I'm going to achieve whatever I'll achieve at the expense of others. I would never support that.
Okay. So another thing that you've said, I've read you say, and I've heard you say it, is how important people have been to the progression of your career, the people who you've met around you. And a lot of the leaders who come on this pod talk about their mentors. And you said that during your career, you appreciated bosses who took the trouble to connect with you. Why was that important?
Yeah, I think so. I think mentors and coaches are so important, irrespective of the level that you are in the business. And I don't always think that coaches should be of a higher position in the organization than yourself. And, you know, I think looking for people you can trust and discuss with and have open conversation. Because I think when you speak to someone, for example, you have a mentor who's already gone through the business, maybe gone through some of the things you're going through. When you can have those chats and say, look, you know, I'm really concerned about this, or I feel I might mess this next role up because I don't feel equipped for it. Having someone say to you, no, that's okay, I felt like that. And this is what I did. And I think, like I mentioned a little bit before, you know, when people have said to you, well, you may consider looking over here or doing something different, or it'll be good in your career path to work in a few different areas. You're engineering based. Why don't you go into corporate for a while? And I think having those discussions are really, really helpful. And I would advise anyone to go and find someone to speak to, irrespective of how senior that person is. Because I can tell you that when I was a director or managing director, EVP or whatever, I really enjoyed those discussions with people. And I'm delighted that a number of those people I've seen really progress because they've shown that interest and they've tried to grasp and understand different things.
So you enjoyed those conversations. Yeah. You enjoyed people banging on your door and saying, excuse me, could I just grab 5 minutes of your time? Let's have a cup of coffee or whatever. Okay, so you're quite obviously a people person. So those emotional intelligence, those qualities there, have they been, do you think, as important to you as a leader as IQ, as the technical learning?
Yes. I might not have realised that at an early age. I didn't know what EQ was at an early age. But I think having that empathy to be able to understand people, to see things from their side, to be able to relate. But I don't think it ends just with EQ, if I'm honest, Mike. I think I would advise anyone, you know, when they're going, maybe graduating, starting a career, to think about not only the competencies they have for the career that they want to go into, but really the transferable skills are really key. So when you're first starting, you know, I think companies still look for people to be dependable, reliable, to be able, in your early years, you know, to follow instruction and to be able to do that. But then as you go through, you know, working in teams, you know, being a leader of a team, having EQ, being able to communicate, et cetera, I think, you know, you could go on and on. But those transferable skills are ultimately that will give you other opportunities and allow you to move beyond your initial discipline. I think that's really important. So, yeah, EQ, totally support what you're saying there. But I think at the same time, the whole transferable skills patch. And a lot of those transferable skills are not only going to come from your education. They'll come from what you do outside. You know, when you're interviewing someone and they say, well, I lead a scouting group, or I'm a captain of a netball team or whatever. You know, those things show some qualities about you and get into quite interesting discussions.
I mean, in your leadership, you were clearly, obviously, hiring people on a consistent basis. What were you looking for? Was that, you know, were you looking for that kind of thing, or that extracurricular type of material?
Certainly. You're looking, of course, for the core competence. You need someone who can come in. But if I look back at Toyota, we were quite often hiring people not for necessarily everything they had now, but what they could be. So there were certain roles in the business. It might be in areas like supply chain and so on. And supply chain degrees, the logistics, those things are very popular now, but probably going back many years ago, were not. And therefore, it takes someone who we think had that aptitude, that energy, that passion, that willing to learn, capability to probably work in a team, collaborate, collaboration skills, those sort of things. And we're really looking for those. And often you find those in the discussions you're having in interview, which were coming from outside.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA to explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. So one of the big issues that obviously leaders face, in fact everybody faces these days, is managing change. And we've talked about the idea of leaders listening to the people who work for them and talking to them. I've read stuff you've written about autonomy, flexibility, keeping people motivated. Tell me how you do all that.
Yeah, I mean, change is just a fact of life, isn't it? And I think there are different types of change. If you don't, change and reinvent your business, you become irrelevant. So those are the changes that you design yourselves. But I don't think those changes don't just happen. You've got to have clear vision and strategy to decide what you're going to change. That's one side of it. And then when we look back over the last 5 years, I moved out to Belgium at the end of 2019 when things seemed quite normal. Of course, then we had COVID. My first real job was closing down all of the European business. Then we had logistics crisis, semiconductor crises. I had a factory in St. Petersburg. I was employing 1,800 Ukrainian workers in Poland and Czech Republic with international conflicts, those kind of things. Then those changes came along. We had to manage them. But I think the leader's role is irrespective of whether these changes are being forced upon you or whether or not they're your decision. You've got to create that vision and strategy and that reason why we want to go where we want to go. You've got to be developing and sharing people that North Star. And I think it's very good not to make that just your plan. You've got to work with your team.
Get buy-in.
Leadership team and get the buy-in at that point and make a very convincing pathway of where we're going to go. But then, if I look at something that I would not have known about Toyota until I joined, was how, certainly working in Toyota, the engagement in continuous improvement for everyone. And as a leader, your job is to be able to engage with the infinite wisdom that the people have who are doing the daily job. And that's for everyone. Everyone entering the company, working for the first time in production, even though they may have been there only a few days or weeks, they're invited to be engaged in improving their own work. Irrespective of what level you are in the business, if you can improve your own work by yourself and have support for the parts you can't do yourself, isn't that a great thing? And doesn't that keep you tremendously engaged?
Absolutely. But isn't that much more difficult now in these days of everything from remote working to social media and the pressures that are on you? Isn't that all the things that you say they're important there, aren't they increasingly difficult?
Well, pressure is created because of the challenges we face. Let's face it, we've all got things we need to get done. We've got targets to achieve. And for me, and I'll come to the remote part in a moment, but face-to-face meeting people, talking about things, isn't that a great way of reducing pressure? Because if I'm a leader and I'm discussing with the team face-to-face and going over, I can understand where they are, where they're struggling, how things are going. Now, that gives me a degree of confidence. So that reduces my pressure. But for that individual, they may have heard a request that someone gave to them from a manager or whatever and probably didn't understand perfectly everything. But when you're face-to-face, aren't you more likely to say, by the way, I didn't quite grasp Can you help me with that? And I think that reduces pressures for them. So I think this, you know, this engagement of face-to-face helps.
So you make time for it. You actively go and pursue face-to-face, one-to-one, perhaps, you know. So you must have been out and about a lot. I mean, running all those factories in across Europe, you must have been there or thereabouts. Spend all your time on the road.
Well, honestly, nothing to be proud of, Mike, but I was, you know, taking about 145 aircraft a year, which was just nature of the job. But, you know, honestly speaking, there was nothing more enjoyable for me than being with them.
And it was worth it.
And it was worth it. The stories and the engagement and what people deliver when they feel that what they're doing is important, you know, is a tremendous thing. And every, you know, the most important people in any business, irrespective, you know, who they are, the most important thing is the people and how you engage the people. I say that again, you know, engaging their infinite wisdom. They are bound to know much more than I know about what makes their work go well or not go so well.
Okay, then, so wait a minute. So tell me about the remote working now, because that makes it more difficult, doesn't it? Surely.
I think it does make it more difficult. And I think the thing is, I think what I would say with remote working is that as a senior leader, it's less easy to really connect in the same way as you would do. You know, you're not always having the opportunity to pull in the whole team in one place and
stand on a soapbox.
No, that's right. I mean, you still have some opportunities like that, and there are other omni-channel ways of communicating these days with people. But I think you have less opportunity, and therefore, I think the role of managers with remote and hybrid working has become so important. And because they are having that one-on-one or one-on-many communication every day. I think it's so important for the managers and the leaders of those managers, because you've got to, who's caring for the managers at the end of the day? You know, they're going to have a lot of challenges with this. I think that giving that time for the communication in a hybrid working, still face-to-face in my opinion, whenever you can, but at least creating time and not just talking about the work, but really connecting with the person and finding out where they are. I think it's so important. And I think with hybrid work, yeah, okay, we're always going to have these are the objectives, the metrics that we want people to work on. But I think also we have to take time to understand preferences. Not everyone's hybrid work is the same. Some people probably like to get up in the morning, 5 a.m., go for a run and, you know, start at 6:30 or something. For other people, that might not be their desire. So I think having a good understanding of how individuals prefer to work and agreeing that up front and discussing that and say, right, yeah, this kind of work from home, this is when we have some expectation to be in the workplace for these reasons. You know, I understand that you prefer to work later in the day, so, you know, I'm not going to make a team meeting at 7 a.m. for everyone because that's not going to happen. And I think that's really important. And, you know, taking the time to check in, even from remote, is important. And I have to say, my view, of course, I came from the time until the last 5 years where, you know, I was going to the office, going to the factory, and kind of working from home was sort of catching up on the stuff they hadn't been able to finish. You know, Sunday night reading up on a presentation I'm giving tomorrow, or you're clearing a few
emails. Oh, yes.
We know that. But I do think the flexible and hybrid working is very important. I'm not yet convinced that 100% remote working is healthy, because culture is so important. And I think in the past, we've always been able to develop and embed culture by the proximity effect of people working together. And of course, we're not having that same situation today. But I still think bringing some people together, making those personal relationships, you know, walking down the corridor, how's it going? And having those discussions that you wouldn't normally have. Honestly, yesterday, I don't know what was up with me, but I got a real grump on when I went to the university.
You know what? You come across as the sort of fellow who never has a grump on. Never has a grump on.
And I was walking. I was going to get a coffee from Blends, the student union bar. And someone walked by me. I didn't know. And a young member of staff said, "Oh, are you Marvin?" I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "Oh, really appreciated that piece you wrote in the Perspective article on the, you know, the company, the organisation website." And that, oh, well, thank you very much. You know, we had a little
chat. It makes you did, isn't
and
it?
And that changed me. I suddenly became a little bit happier. So I wouldn't have had that opportunity if I was in my home side of my own desk.
Yeah, I've got you. Okay. So 30 years, looking back on your leadership career, anything you think, oh, Lord, I wish I hadn't done that?
Well, of course there are. I mean, I don't really regret business decisions, because I think when you're making business decisions, you're doing it with your team, you're doing it with the best available information. And, you know, I think there are always going to be things that, you know, the mistakes, and I think you learn from mistakes. I will worry about people not making mistakes than, you know, trying something and pushing the boundaries a bit and making mistakes. But, you know, that, I don't regret that. I think when I was younger, I could be, I could raise my voice a bit. I could get a little bit sharp at times. And I think as I've got older, kind of engage brain
you
before mouth.
You mellowed with age?
I think I take a pause.
You take a pause?
Okay. I take a pause. I think that's the one thing, because you look back and think, oh, because if I learn anything, you've got to put yourself in their shoes. And I think, you know, I've had leaders who've done that to me, and I've walked away and it's not been a great feeling, you know, and I'm thinking, well, I've just done that to them now. So, and it's very difficult to recover.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is that something you, is it, with age and experience, you've recognised?
I think so, yeah, yeah. I tried to get rid of it at quite an early age, but I think when I was a young manager, when you're under a lot of pressure and, you know, you're feeling also, you know, a little bit of fear of failure yourself, you want things to go right, and you see something's not going so right, it's easy to get a bit grumpy. And I don't think it makes things better. There's a time where you've got to show if you're unhappy with something, but I think there are ways of doing it.
Okay. And looking back again, what are you most proud of? That best leadership decision?
You know, I think there's a personal pride and a kind of...
And a professional.
A professional pride, if I may say like that. I think personally, putting myself out of the comfort zone, because I got into engineering and I ended up in leadership, and that wasn't necessarily an easy decision or pathway. And I think from a personal point of view, I'm very pleased that I did that, because I think it's given me a lot of opportunity to do many things that I would not have otherwise had. I think from a business point of view, there are many things or times you're proud of, but I don't know, one simple one. I was running Toyota in the UK through the Brexit negotiations, and that was really, of course, a challenging period, because, you know, more than 80% of the business was with Europe, so you can imagine the challenges. And at that time, and, you know, along with the team, I took the decision that we would go into not only vehicle production but do other revenue generating work, you know, customization, preparing vehicles for the police fleet, doing on-site repair. And that was very different, because that kind of work had always been done outside. And I got a lot of people saying to me, look, this is not what we do in a car making factory. But I stuck with it, and we moved it ahead. And it was very interesting, because I was then out in Japan, and we're very senior level in Japan. They got really interested in this. And I didn't realise quite at the time why it was so important to them too, because they said, look, this is a real good example. You've got to share this. And if you think about the industry today, automotive industry, and how it's going forward with electrification, I think just making product is not enough.
Right.
And how you can grasp more of the value chain. And therefore, what I was doing was kind of post-production value chain, you know, bringing it into the business. So I was quite pleased with that, because I had enough people telling me I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But in the end, it turned out right.
I don't want to take you off on a tangent here, but I'm intrigued. Where did the idea come from then?
Well, I think at that time, I was working with my top management team. You know, we were based in Derby. Okay, you've got to look at what's the worst case scenario. What's the worst case scenario if we face, you know, 10% tariffs on everything we're making? Then we had to do a cost reduction activity. Naturally, that's very understandable. But I think just doing cost reduction by itself is never a great thing. You know, you end up cutting into the bone if you're not careful. And therefore, how do you find revenue generating opportunities? And that's what we really got into, a big discussion on that, and looking, well, there are other people doing work that probably we can do. And looking at the talent that we had within the workforce and the flexibility of that workforce, and when we discussed it with them, they were well keen. And we thought that we could add value to those processes by taking the expertise we had in making cars the first time. If we applied some of that thinking to the post-production, customization, rework, refurbishment, we could probably do it at least as good as others, if I say like that. And it built up, you know. We tried it small, first of all, and now it I think it's employing towards 200 people now.
Is that right? I mean, you make it sound so matter of fact, so straightforward, and yet at the time it hadn't been done. It was innovation.
No, it was inside of the, you know, the broader Toyota business. There were people thinking about it, but it wasn't being done. And you know, and I realise now, as I say, there was a huge degree of interest in Japan because they realised that the future of automotive was going to be quite challenging. You know, connected, autonomous, shared, electrified vehicles is the kind of buzzword that people are using, and that brought a lot of challenge. It was going to bring new players into the game, as we've seen. And therefore, how can we make broader business? And Toyota talked a lot, Akio Toyota, about, he talked about moving from an automotive company to a mobility company. And when you think about that, there are many opportunities that you can get into to create value.
Great stuff. Great stuff. So finally, I know you're a professor now at along the road at the University of Derby. Derby Business School, but you're a graduate of this institution, Nottingham Trent. So what one piece of leadership advice from your career might you have for the undergrads, the grads, the postgrads, the partners who are seeking to follow in your footsteps from here?
It's a bit tight, giving me only one, if I'm honest. But,
I'll tell you what, you can have as many as you wish.
I'll start with one. And I think, you know, that last week just caught my ear when you said follow in the footsteps. And for some people, that's fine. You might want to do that. You know, you may see some pathway that you want to follow, and that's fine. But I would always say to people, look, there's going to be a lot of people telling you what they think you should do, what they expect you to do, whether it be parents, colleagues, friends, you know, whatever. And I think you've got to decide and make the expectations for yourself. And it's not a problem, because if you make mistakes early, you're fine. You've got a long life ahead of you to come back. So make your own way. Because if people are not doing that, there's not going to be the Elon Musk of the world or whatever. There will never be the disruptors. So that's the first thing. And but you did say leadership. And I think, you know, in leadership, remember it's not about you as a leader. You've got to invert the pyramid of the organisation. So you're at the bottom. You're there to support the organisation to be able to achieve. You're there to create the right culture and environment for people to be able to achieve. You're there to give the opportunity for those with the infinite wisdom to be able to apply that. So really, it's not about you. It's about others. And I think that's something I would really say. Never forget that. And it's something that I've had to learn along the way, and I hope I stick with that today. But yeah.
Good stuff. Hey, listen, Marvin Cook, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very, very much for being our guest here on the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with Martin Cook, OBE, former Vice President of Toyota Europe, why not listen to our other episodes with Nadeem Raza, CEO of transport tech company Microlise, David Edwards, MD of watchmaker Seiko UK, or Nick Beaton, former chief exec of global e-commerce giant ASOS. This episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.